keeps a ledger of the years I've spent, soft folds and silver markings every small amend.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
I'm so excited to jump into this one today.
You know, there is this incredibly universal, yet somehow deeply personal moment that almost everyone experiences. It's like an ambush.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Usually it just sneaks up on you right around your mid-30s. You're going about your life feeling pretty invincible, right? Operating under the assumption that your body is a perfectly self-sustaining machine.
Right. You still think of yourself as a person who can stay up until 3 a.m, eat a heavy meal, and just wake up feeling perfectly fine.
Exactly. Yeah. And then one day, it just hits you like a literal sack of bricks.
It's that sudden, jarring realization of your own biological mortality.
Yeah. You realize you aren't immortal anymore. And the thing is, it rarely announces itself with a dramatic drum roll. It starts with the tiny, insidious little things.
Maintenance lights on the dashboard.
Exactly. You're driving at night and the streetlights look a little blurry. Or, you know, you're sitting in a dimly lit restaurant and you catch yourself holding the menu at arm's length. And you realize with this sinking feeling that you might actually need reading glasses.
Or you wake up and your knee just aches.
Yeah.
For absolutely no reason.
Yes, you didn't run a marathon, you didn't trip, you literally just slept at a slightly weird angle. And it's that profound, somewhat depressing realization that the effortless upward swing of youth has leveled off and the decline has officially begun.
It really is the exact moment you become consciously aware of your own biology as a tangible, degrading entity.
Yeah.
Up until that point, your body was just a vehicle that reliably got you from point A to point B.
It asked for very little in return.
Right. And suddenly, it's a vehicle with a glowing check engine light that requires constant preventative maintenance.
Yeah. And for the vast majority of human history, the response to that realization has basically been, well, that's life. Time to accept it and age gracefully.
Just kind of fade into the background.
Exactly. But what if we didn't just have to passively accept this decline? What if, instead of gracefully fading and watching our physical capabilities shrink, we could actually fight it?
I mean, that is the ultimate human question, isn't it?
And I don't mean with magic or snake oil or, you know, vague wellness myths. I mean with hard, targeted cellular science.
What's fascinating, if we look at the historical context here, is that humans have been actively trying to fight this exact process since the dawn of recorded civilization. The desire to halt aging isn't some modern obsession.
It's not just a Silicon Valley tech bro thing.
Not at all. It is transcultural and incredibly ancient. If we look back to the 5th century BC, we see the Greek historian Herodotus describing a fabled fountain of youth belonging to the Macrobians, which was this legendary group of people said to live for over a century.
Wow.
Yeah, and you have ancient texts placing similar rejuvenating fountains in India, in the mythical land of Bimini, and of course the legends surrounding Ponce de Leon in Florida.
So we've always been obsessed with finding the pause button. We just had terrible tools for doing it.
Absolutely terrible tools. In ancient India, there was the pursuit of Amrit, the nectar of immortality described in Hindu scriptures. In ancient China, they literally thought that consuming heavy metals like gold and mercury would confer everlasting life because those elements didn't degrade.
Oh, wow. Mercury. That's rough.
Yeah, in fact, Qin Shi Huang, the infamous first emperor of China, the guy who united the country and built the first iterations of the Great Wall, was so obsessed with immortality that he ironically died at the age of 49.
Wait, really? How?
From ingesting cinnabar, which gave him fatal mercury poisoning.
I mean, to talk about the ultimate backfire, he literally poisoned his own cellular machinery, trying to force it to live forever.
Precisely. So the goal hasn't changed in thousands of years, but thankfully our tools have evolved astronomically. Today, instead of blindly drinking mercury or searching for mythical springs, we have the astonishing field of molecular and cellular biology.
We can actually see what's happening.
Right. We can sequence DNA, we can quantify specific replication errors, and we can peer into the absolute smallest corners of our organelles to see exactly where the biological machinery is breaking down at an atomic level.
Which sets the stage perfectly for today's deep dive. We are exploring a truly fascinating, highly comprehensive framework that attempts to not only decode the cellular mechanics of aging, but to actively halt the process.
It's an incredible body of work.
We are unpacking the science and the strategy laid out in a book called Why We Age and How to Stop It, The Kaufman Protocol, by Dr. Sandra Kaufman.
And Dr. Kaufman is a highly compelling figure to be synthesizing this kind of massive, complex data set. She isn't just a casual observer of biology or, you know, a longevity influencer.
Right, she's the real deal.
She's a practicing physician and a heavily credentialed scientist. As an undergraduate, she actually discovered a novel dispersal mechanism for an invasive plant species, which led her to pursue a master's degree in ecology and evolutionary biology.
And her specific focus during that time was on cellular plasticity under changing environmental conditions, right?
Exactly. And that is such a crucial foundation. When you're looking at how the human body adapts, or more accurately, fails to adapt over time, having a background in evolutionary cellular plasticity gives you a completely different lens than someone who just studies isolated pharmacology.
Yeah, it allows you to view the cell not just as a static entity, but as an organism constantly negotiating with its environment.
But she didn't stop at evolutionary biology. She went on to medical school, completed her residency and a fellowship at Johns Hopkins, and is currently the chief of pediatric anesthesia at a major children's hospital in Florida.
Let's just pause on that for a second. Pediatric anesthesia, I mean, that is a field with zero margin for error.
Absolutely zero.
You have to have a flawless understanding of human physiology, pharmacology, and metabolic pathways to safely anesthetize a child.
It requires an absolute critical precision. So she spends her days deeply immersed in the immediate life or death mechanics of human physiology. But beyond her professional credentials, her personal life adds a whole other necessary layer to her expertise.
She's an athlete, right?
A fiercely avid athlete. She climbs mountains. She literally hangs from cliffs. She runs, bikes, and swims. She understands exercise physiology, tissue repair, and oxygen debt, not just from reading a textbook, but from constantly pushing her own physical limits.
And that ties directly into why she spent years of her life writing this book. She explicitly states her motivation, and I find it incredibly relatable.
Oh, completely.
She says she simply loved her life. She loved climbing, she loved running, she loved doing her highly demanding job, and she decided she just didn't want it destroyed by the seemingly inevitable progressive decay we call aging.
So she decided to use her background, her analytical brain, and her intense determination to figure out the mechanisms of that decay and stop it.
Yeah. If we pull back and look at the scope of her work, she represents this unique intersection of deep evolutionary biological research and practical lived physiology.
She spent years uncovering highly relevant scientific data, burying herself in obscure studies from Japan, analyzing ancient Indian herbal traditions, dissecting contemporary cellular biology papers, and synthesized it all into a cohesive, actionable, theoretical model.
Okay, let's unpack this carefully. Before we get into the actual biological mechanics of her framework, we need to set some really clear, non-negotiable ground rules for you, the listener.
Yes, this is very important.
Everything we are going to discuss in this deep dive represents Dr. Kaufman's personal perspective, her own synthesis of the available research, and her specific theoretical Kaufman protocol.
This is a vital distinction to make. What we are exploring today is a descriptive overview of her scientific synthesis.
Right. This is not medical advice. This is not a set of instructions for you to go out and start taking handfuls of molecules. And it is not established, universally accepted scientific fact by the broader medical community.
It is a fascinating, deeply researched exploration of one physician's approach to the aging problem.
Exactly. We are exploring the science she presents and the conclusions she draws purely to understand how she views the biological battlefield of aging.
And viewing it as a battlefield, or rather, a highly complex, interconnected system, is exactly where her framework begins. Because you cannot fix a system if you don't understand how it breaks.
And you can't understand how it breaks if you don't understand how it operates under optimal conditions.
Exactly.
That brings us to part one of our deep dive, Why We Age. Dr. Kaufman uses a brilliant, highly accessible analogy to ground all of this incredibly dense biochemistry. She asks us to picture the human body as a highly complex factory.
But we aren't talking about a simple linear assembly line like Henry Ford's early setups.
No, definitely not.
We are talking about a massive, ultra-sophisticated facility with crisscrossing pathways, circular workflows, feedback loops, and highly specialized departments that all have to coordinate perfectly in time and space.
It's a very elegant way to visualize the body. Because no matter how complex a factory is, whether it's building microchips or human tissues, it still has basic, fundamental requirements to operate.
Right. It absolutely needs an operating manual. It needs a power plant to generate electricity.
It needs a dedicated maintenance crew to fix broken machinery. a security team to keep out intruders, workers on the factory floor, and a reliable, efficient waste management system to take out the inevitable trash.
So, if we want to understand why the factory breaks down, why we experience aging, we have to look at each of these departments individually and see exactly what goes wrong at the molecular level.
Let's start with the very top, the instruction manual. In the human factory, that manual is our genetic information system, our DNA.
DNA is the ultimate standard operating procedure. It dictates absolutely everything that happens on the factory floor.
It's the blueprint for the big, obvious, macroscopic things, yeah. Right? Like the fact that you have one head, two arms, and perfectly centered facial features.
Yeah, but also the invisible micro details, like the specific folded texture of your hair proteins, or the exact concentration of melanin in your eyes. Every single instruction for every protein, fiber, cell, and enzyme is inscribed in that 3 billion letter code.
You know, for decades, the holy grail in gerontology and aging research was finding the proverbial aging gene.
Yeah.
The media loved this idea.
Oh, they were obsessed with it.
The thought was that maybe there's just one master switch we could flip, one gene we could edit with CRISPR to just turn off the aging process entirely. But as we dig into Dr. Kaufman's research, it becomes glaringly obvious that it's not that simple, is it?
No, not at all. Biology rarely offers a single master switch. There is no isolated aging gene. Instead, as the research has evolved over the last few decades, scientists have identified and categorized specific groups of genes that exert immense control over the pace of the aging process.
And Dr. Kaufman highlights a few key categories, starting with what she broadly terms lifespan regulators.
Right.
These are like the environmental sensors for the factory, right? They sit up in the corporate office looking out the window to see what the economy is doing.
That's a great way to conceptualize it.
Right.
They constantly monitor what is happening in the outside environment
yeah.
and adjust the factory's internal operations accordingly.
Okay, so give us an example of how that works.
A classic, heavily studied example here is the biological response to caloric restriction. It has been documented for nearly 100 years in the scientific literature, going all the way back to Clive McKay's rat studies at Cornell in the 1930s, that restricting calories can significantly prolong lifespan in a wide variety of organisms.
We've seen this phenomenon replicated in yeast, fruit flies, roundworms, fish, rodents, and even primates, right?
Exactly.
But wait, I need to push back on this a little bit because it sounds counterintuitive.
Yeah.
If I restrict the factory's raw materials, the food shouldn't the factory break down faster? Why does starving the body make it live longer? What are these genes actually doing?
It's actually a brilliant evolutionary adaptation. When you restrict calories, usually a 20 to 50% reduction from a standard diet without causing actual malnutrition, the body senses that the environment is hostile.
Like, food is scarce, winter is coming.
Exactly. If the factory keeps operating at maximum capacity, building new cells and expending massive energy, it will burn through its reserves and die. So these lifespan regulator genes detect the lack of incoming energy and kick in.
They sound the alarm.
They send a factory-wide memo saying, hey, resources are critically low, we need to halt new growth, conserve our existing energy, and divert all available resources to repairing and maintaining the machinery we already have.
Oh, I see. It shifts the biological priority from reproduction and growth to preservation and maintenance. It hunkers down to weather the storm.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. And a major famous player in this category of regulators is the sirtuin gene family. Sirtuins are a class of proteins that act as environmental sensors.
And what do they do when the alarm sounds?
When they're activated by the stress of caloric restriction, they go into the nucleus and physically interact with your DNA. They literally remove chemical tags called acetyl groups from the proteins that DNA wraps around.
Okay, and that does what exactly?
This causes the DNA to tightly coil up, silencing unnecessary genes and initiating a massive, protective, life-extending response.
So they essentially lock down the non-essential parts of the instruction manual. That's incredible. But here's the thing. Caloric restriction sounds miserable. I really like lunch.
Most people do. And that is the fascinating part of Dr. Kaufman's toolkit, which we'll explore later. Science is aggressively searching for molecules that can artificially activate these sirtuin genes.
Essentially tricking the body into thinking it's starving without us actually having to skip lunch.
Exactly. You get the benefits without the misery.
I am very much looking forward to that part. But beyond these environmental regulators, Dr. Kaufman also talks about mediator genes. If the regulators are the executives sensing the outside market, the mediators are middle management.
Yes. The executives don't go down to the factory floor to turn the wrenches. The mediator genes receive the signal from the regulators, like the sirtuins, and then incite the production of specific action proteins.
These are often enzymes, right? Like kinases or transcription factors.
Right.
Let's define that really quickly for the listener. What is a kinase and what is a transcription factor in the context of our factory?
Well, a transcription factor is a protein that binds to specific DNA sequences to control the rate of transcription of genetic information from DNA to messenger RNA. It's the middle manager taking the blueprint and handing it to the construction crew.
Got it. And the kinase?
A kinase is an enzyme that acts as a switch. It chemically modifies other proteins by adding a phosphate group to them, which usually turns that protein's function on or off.
So the mediators use transcription factors and kinases to actually go down to the factory floor and alter how the cell is functioning based on the executive orders.
Exactly. So the instruction manual is incredibly dynamic. It's not a dusty, static book sitting on a shelf. It is constantly rewriting daily orders based on environmental stress.
But none of those orders matter and none of those machines run if the factory doesn't have a power grid. Which brings us to the most famous organelle in biology, the mitochondria, the power plant of the cell.
Oh, this is where we have to take a quick detour into evolutionary biology, because to understand why the power plant fails as we age, you have to understand its bizarre origin story.
It's such a cool story.
Dr. Kopman refers to it as a utilitarian yet incredibly beautiful relationship that started billions of years ago.
I love how she frames this. She describes it as a microscopic corporate merger, or more accurately, a hostile takeover that turned into a permanent monopoly.
That's the end of symbiotic theory. Billions of years ago, you had this big primitive eukaryotic cell. It was ambitious, it was growing, but its energy production was incredibly inefficient.
It was just fermenting stuff, right?
Yeah. It had to rely on anaerobic glycolysis, which yields very little energy. It was essentially limited by its own terrible power grid.
Meanwhile, floating around in the primordial soup, you had a much smaller, highly savvy, free-living bacterial cell, an alpha proteobacterium.
And this little bacterium had developed an incredibly efficient oxygen-based energy system. It was producing a massive power surplus.
Right. So according to the endosymbiotic theory, which is universally accepted in biology today, the larger inefficient cell physically engulfed the smaller energy-efficient bacterium.
But instead of digesting it for food, a symbiosis occurred.
The big cell realized, wait, if I keep you alive inside me, you can generate all my power.
Exactly. The big cell provided a safe environment and raw nutrients, and the little bacterium provided a massive influx of energy.
The perfect trade.
Over millions of years, they became completely genetically interdependent. The bacterium transferred most of its DNA to the host cell's nucleus, but it kept a tiny circular piece of its own DNA.
Which is why your mitochondria have their own separate DNA today.
Yes. Today, the descendants of those little engulfed bacteria are the mitochondria powering every single human cell.
And their specific critical job in our factory analogy is to take raw materials like the glucose and fatty acids from the food we eat and convert them into usable electricity. What is that cellular electricity?
In the cellular world, that electricity is a molecule called ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. Every single cellular function that requires energy, whether it's a muscle contracting, a neuron firing, or a protein being built, relies on breaking the chemical bonds of ATP.
It is the absolute non-negotiable currency of life.
Without a doubt.
Okay, but here's where the aging problem kicks in. Just like a coal power plant or a nuclear reactor, generating all that immense energy comes with severe wear and tear. How exactly does the microscopic power plant rust?
It comes down to the actual mechanism of how ATP is made. Inside the mitochondria, there is a system called the electron transport chain. You can think of it as a microscopic bucket brigade.
A bucket brigade, I like that.
Electrons are stripped from the food we eat and passed down a line of four major protein complexes. As these electrons bounce down the line, their energy is used to pump protons across a membrane, creating a gradient.
And then what happens?
That gradient then spins a tiny biological motor called ATP synthase, which churns out ATP.
It's literally a microscopic hydroelectric dam. That is mind-blowing. But where does the damage come from?
Well, the bucket brigade isn't perfect. As those electrons are being rapidly passed down the line, some of them inevitably slip. They leak out of the chain.
Uh-oh.
And when a rogue electron leaks out, it aggressively attaches itself to the nearest oxygen molecule. This creates something called a superoxide radical.
A free radical?
Yes. A highly reactive, unstable molecule. These free radicals are like sparks flying out of a furnace.
And they just bounce around causing havoc.
Exactly. They bounce around inside the mitochondria, physically damaging the lipids in the membrane, destroying the transport proteins, and most devastatingly, mutating that tiny, unprotected piece of mitochondrial DNA.
So they're destroying their own blueprint.
Over time, as this damage accumulates, the mitochondria become less efficient. They produce less ATP and leak more sparks. It's a vicious, compounding cycle of power failure.
So, as we age, our cells are literally running on a depleting power grid while simultaneously catching on fire. That naturally brings us to the next department in Dr. Kaufman's factory, quality control and cellular maintenance.
Because if sparks are flying and things are breaking, someone has to clean it up.
Great. If you build a brand new factory, for the first few years, everything is shiny. The pipes are clean, the assembly lines run smoothly, the floors are spotless. But over time, the infrastructure inevitably falls apart due to constant use.
In the body, our cells face relentless exposure to both internal insults, like those free radicals we just discussed, and external insults from the environment. The two most critical structures that suffer this damage are our proteins and our DNA.
Let's talk about the proteins first, because people hear the word protein and they think of a chicken breast or a protein shake. But in the context of the factory, proteins are the actual machines, right?
Proteins are absolutely everything to a cell. The structural scaffolding of the cell is made of proteins. The enzymes that run chemical reactions are proteins. The receptors that receive messages are proteins.
They are the gears, the levers, and the conveyor belts.
Yes, but a protein only works if it is folded into a very specific, complex 3D shape.
And when those free radicals hit a protein, they dent it. They ruin the shape.
Precisely. The protein becomes misfolded or oxidized. It stops doing its job and just becomes physical junk, taking up space.
So what does the cell do with the junk?
Well, every cell has a highly complex quality control system. It has chaperone proteins that try to refold the damaged proteins. If they can't be fixed, the cell uses a microscopic garbage disposal called the proteasome to shred the damaged protein into amino acids so they can be recycled.
And what about the instruction manual? You mentioned DNA gets damaged too.
Constantly. Our DNA accumulates damage at a much faster rate than most people realize. Just sitting here, the DNA in each of your cells is experiencing tens of thousands of lesions every single day.
Just from being alive.
UV radiation from the sun, toxins in the air, and our own internal metabolic byproducts cause base modifications, single-strand breaks, and the highly dangerous double-strand breaks.
But the good news is that our cells have brilliant surveillance and repair crews. We have enzymes constantly scanning the DNA, snipping out errors, and stitching it back together. We have a process called autophagy, where the cell literally eats its own damaged organelles to clean up the factory floor.
That's true. But the bad news, and this is the absolute crux of biological aging, according to Dr. Kaufman, is that eventually these robust repair systems simply get overwhelmed.
They just can't keep up.
The damage, the free radicals, the mutations, the misfolded proteins occurs faster than the repair crews can work. The chaperones get exhausted, the proteasome gets gunked up, they fall behind on the backlog.
The rust accumulates, the pipes start to leak, the gears grind, and the overall functional capacity of the factory begins a slow, inexorable decline.
And while the internal maintenance crew is overwhelmed, you also have massive external threats trying to breach the factory walls.
Which brings us to our security department, the immune system. We live in a world filled with hostile invaders, bacteria, viruses, fungal spores, parasites.
To handle this endless siege, the body has a multi-tiered defense system. Dr. Kaufman breaks it down very simply into two main branches, the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system.
The innate system is like the emergency first responders, the paramedics, the firemen, the ER docs. They're fast, they're aggressive, but they are relatively non-specific.
Right. They treat the immediate trauma. They don't care what exactly broke down the door. They just rush to the breach to kill it and seal it.
Hmm.
The innate system includes physical barriers like our skin, but also mechanical and chemical defenses.
Right, like in our lungs.
For instance, our lungs are constantly bombarded with microscopic foreign particles and pathogens with every breath. So the cells lining our respiratory tract have tiny little hair-like projections called cilia.
And what do they do?
These cilia are in constant synchronized motion, literally sweeping mucus and trapped irritants up and out of the lungs to be swallowed or coughed out.
And then you have the cellular components of the innate system, like macrophages. I always picture macrophages as the microscopic Pac-Men of the body. They just patrol the tissues, find something that doesn't belong, and swallow it whole.
That's exactly what they do. And then we have the second branch, the adaptive system. This is the highly specialized intelligence agency. the T cells and B cells.
They don't just blindly attack.
No, they identify specific chemical signatures of specific threats, mount a highly targeted counterattack, and most importantly, they store the memory of that specific attacker so they can neutralize it instantly if it ever returns.
It's an incredibly sophisticated security force, but this is where I have to ask a major pushback question on behalf of the listener. If our immune system is so incredibly smart and adaptable, why does aging make us so vulnerable to diseases? What happens when the security guards themselves get old?
You've hit on an extremely critical and highly researched area of gerontology. Dr. Kaufman points out that over time, these very security mechanisms begin to degrade and, terrifyingly, can actually turn against the company they are supposed to protect.
Oh, wow.
It's a concept known in the scientific literature as inflammaging.
Inflammaging. Inflammation and aging. How does that happen?
As the immune cells age, their communication networks break down. They start producing chronic, low-level alarms. We also accumulate something called senescent cells.
What are those?
These are cells that have suffered too much DNA damage to keep dividing, but instead of quietly dying off through a programmed mechanism called apoptosis, they refuse to die. They become zombie cells.
Zombie cells? That sounds terrible. What do?
They sit in your tissues and constantly secrete a toxic cocktail of inflammatory cytokines. It's called the senescence-associated secretory phenotype, or SASP. They are essentially screaming for the immune system to come fix them, but they can't be fixed.
So it's like a broken fire alarm.
Exactly. So the macrophages and first responders rush to the area, get confused, and end up causing collateral damage to healthy tissue. The security guards become hyperactive, perpetually stressed, and they start shooting at shadows.
And that causes systemic problems.
That chronic, smoldering inflammation accelerates the breakdown of the entire factory, contributing to everything from arthritis to cardiovascular disease.
That is a terrifying image, the security guards going rogue and burning down the factory. So we have the failing instruction manual, the leaking power plant, the overwhelmed maintenance crew, and the rogue security guards. Now let's talk about the actual workers on the factory floor. Cellular turnover.
Right, the worker bees.
One detail from Dr. Kaufman's text that absolutely blew my mind was the realization that not all of our cells are the same age. We instinctively think of ourselves as one cohesive, chronological age. I am 35 years old, but my cells are on vastly different timelines.
The varying lifespans of our cellular worker bees present entirely different, highly specialized challenges for the body. Some cells are highly disposable, temporary interns, and some are absolute lifers who have been working at the factory since the day you were born.
Let's look at the temporary interns first. Dr. Kaufman mentions that the cells lining our gastrointestinal tract are replaced every 1 to 5 days.
Which, if you think about the environment they operate in, makes perfect sense. Our stomachs are literal vats of highly acidic fluid and aggressive digestive enzymes designed to break down tissue. Those epithelial cells are constantly being chemically burned and macerated.
It's a rough job.
Because of that brutal environment, the body doesn't even try to repair them. It relies on a strategy of rapid turnover. Stem cells in the gut constantly churn out new lining, and the old, damaged cells are simply sloughed off.
And there's a crazy fact about this in the book, right?
Yeah, in fact, as Dr. Kaufman notes, this turnover is so massive that even if you were to undergo a strict water fast and not eat anything for days, your body would still produce physical waste. Why? Because you were continuously discarding millions of these short-lived digestive cells.
That is deeply weird but fascinating. Then you have slightly longer-term workers. The cells on the surface of your skin take roughly 10 to 30 days to fully turn over and shed. Red blood cells, which are constantly squeezing through tight capillaries and getting physically battered, last about 4 months before the spleen filters them out and recycles their iron.
But then you have the lifers.
The neurons, your brain cells.
For the most part, the neurons you have in your brain right now are the exact same neurons you had when you were a toddler. They are going to live for decades, potentially your entire lifespan.
Wow.
And this is a critical distinction in the science of aging, because the rate-limiting factors for a cell that lives for 5 days versus a cell that lives for 80 years are completely different.
How so?
A gut cell doesn't have to worry about long-term DNA mutations or this slow accumulation of metabolic waste because it dies before that stuff becomes a problem. But a brain cell...
It's stuck there.
A brain cell has to survive decades of accumulated oxidative stress from the mitochondria, decades of heavy metal exposure, decades of misfolded proteins. It has to constantly repair itself because it doesn't have the luxury of simply dividing and being swapped out for a fresh replacement.
Wait, why can't brain cells just divide like skin cells?
Because the wiring. Your memories, your skills, your personality are physically encoded in the unimaginably complex web of synaptic connections between your neurons. If a neuron just decided to split in two, it would sever all those connections.
It would be like randomly cutting the wires in a supercomputer.
Exactly. So evolutionary biology demands that these cells stay put and prioritize extreme long-term repair mechanisms. When those mechanisms fail, we see neurodegenerative diseases.
Which perfectly transitions us to the final department of the factory. Waste management. Creating energy, building proteins, and sustaining life inherently creates garbage. You either have to truck it out, bury it, or burn it. But you absolutely cannot ignore it.
The byproducts of biological life are constant and deeply problematic. The most obvious immediate one is carbon dioxide. Every single time our mitochondria produce ATP, they produce CO2 as a waste product.
And then we just exhale it.
It enters the blood, travels to the lungs, and we exhale it. But if we couldn't get rid of it, if you hold your breath, that CO2 converts to carbonic acid. It would drop your blood pH and make you fatally acidotic in minutes.
But CO2 is the easy trash to take out. What about the hard stuff? Dr. Kaufman points out the profound, almost cruel irony of the two chemical elements we need most to survive, oxygen and glucose.
It's so true.
We literally cannot live for more than a few minutes without oxygen, and our brains demand massive amounts of glucose. But over time, they are both incredibly detrimental to the factory.
It is the ultimate biological paradox. We discussed oxygen a moment ago with the mitochondria. We absolutely need oxygen to act as the final electron acceptor in the electron transport chain. Without it, ATP production halts instantly.
But the very act of using it is dangerous.
The very process of utilizing that oxygen generates those superoxide-free radicals. Oxygen, by its chemical nature, wants to oxidize things. It rusts metal, and it rusts our cells.
And glucose is just as tricky, right? Because for 99% of human evolution, sugar was incredibly scarce. You might find some berries in the summer or some wild honey if you were lucky.
Exactly.
So our bodies evolved these brilliant, intricate hormonal mechanisms like insulin to hoard it. We absorb it rapidly, send it to the liver, use what the brain needs immediately, and store every single excess drop as fat for the inevitable winter famine.
But the environment changed faster than our genes could adapt. Today, we live in an engineered world of absolute glucose abundance. We are drowning in refined carbohydrates.
We never get to the famine part.
And Dr. Kaufman points out a very specific, frustrating reality of the aging instruction manual. As we get older, our epigenetic programming actually shifts. The factory changes its instructions to make us store more fat, regardless of whether we're overeating or not. And far worse, it changes where we store that fat.
You're talking about the dreaded middle belly fat, the spare tire that just appears in your late 30s and refuses to leave.
Exactly. When we are young, we store fat subcutaneously, just under the skin. But aging causes the body to start packing this fat deep inside the abdominal cavity, wrapping it around our inner organs like the liver and intestines. This is known as visceral fat.
And this isn't just a cosmetic annoyance, is it?
Not at all. Visceral fat is highly, dangerously metabolically active.
Active how? It's not just inert blubber.
No, visceral fat functions almost like a rogue endocrine organ. It constantly secretes inflammatory cytokines directly into your portal vein, bombarding your liver. It directly contributes to the systemic inflammaging we talked about with the rogue security guards.
Wow, so it's actively hurting you.
It drives insulin resistance.
Yep.
It is literally toxic waste piling up around the factory's vital machines.
And it's not just the fat. Dr. Kaufman also talks about what glucose does directly to our proteins, a process called glycation.
Yes, and this is crucial for the toolkit we will discuss later. When you have too much free glucose floating around your bloodstream, those sugar molecules act like sticky, chaotic toddlers.
I love that analogy.
They physically crash into your proteins, like the collagen in your skin or the elastin in your blood vessels, and permanently attach themselves to them without any enzymatic control.
This is what she refers to as AGEs, right? Advanced glycation end products.
Correct. It is literally the Maillard reaction happening inside your body. The Maillard reaction is what turns bread into brown toast, or what sears the outside of a steak. It's the caramelization of proteins and sugars.
That sounds terrible for a cell.
Over decades, your tissues are slowly caramelizing. Your blood vessels become stiff instead of elastic, driving up blood pressure. Your skin loses its spring and wrinkles. Your eye lenses become cloudy. It is a slow, sticky destruction of the factory's physical infrastructure.
Okay, let's take a breath and summarize this massive amount of damage. The instruction manual gets misread or silenced by epigenetic changes. The mitochondrial power plant leaks sparks and slowly destroys itself.
The maintenance crews of chaperones and proteasomes get completely overwhelmed by misfolded proteins.
The immune security guards go rogue, become senescent zombies, and cause systemic fires. The long-term workers, our neurons, struggle under the weight of decades of stress. And toxic garbage visceral fat and caramelized AGEs is piling up everywhere.
It paints an incredibly grim, seemingly hopeless picture of the factory.
If you stop there, it is highly depressing. But understanding the exact molecular mechanisms of how and where the factory breaks down is the absolute necessary first step. You cannot design a specific tool if you don't know the exact shape of the broken bolt. Which brings us to the pivot. Here's where it gets really interesting and where the hope comes back in. Because Dr. Kaufman doesn't just leave us staring at a burning, broken factory. She spent years researching the specific molecular tools that exist in nature and in pharmacology that can go into these distinct specialized departments and actively repair the machinery.
Which launches us into part two of our deep dive, the toolkit.
And before we open this toolkit, we must vigorously remind the listener. We are now entering the realm of Dr. Kaufman's specific protocols, interpretations, and hypotheses.
We are going to walk through the families of molecules she reviews and describe what they broadly target at a cellular level. We are remaining entirely descriptive of her text.
We are not recommending daily regimens. We are not validating these claims as universally proven clinical facts. And we are absolutely not providing dosing instructions. This is an exploration of one scientist's highly researched strategy.
A perfectly stated disclaimer. Let's open up this molecular toolkit and see how Dr. Kaufman proposes fixing the factory.
I want to look at these tools not as a random list, but by grouping them to the specific factory departments we just explored. Let's start with the instruction manual. How do we fix the epigenetic signaling? How do we talk to the sirtuins?
Dr. Kaufman brings out a tool she calls the Enigma resveratrol, and its lesser known but highly potent cousin, terostilbin.
Resveratrol is a deeply fascinating molecule because, as Dr. Kaufman notes in her research, it has historically seemed omnipotent in some studies and frustratingly useless in others, hence the Enigma.
But its history is undeniable. It is a highly active chemical component found in the skin of red grapes, but more potently in a plant called Japanese knotweed. It has been used medicinally for over 2,000 years in Ayurvedic, Japanese, and traditional Chinese medicine.
Right, people were using this stuff to treat fungal infections, cardiovascular issues, and general systemic inflammation millennia before humanity even knew what a molecule was. Even today, Itadori tea, which is brewed from knotweed, is used as a potent herbal remedy. But what is it actually doing in the cell?
In the context of our factory, resveratrol acts as a profound epigenetic signaling molecule. We talked earlier about how the stress of caloric restriction activates the sirtuin genes to pause growth and initiate deep cellular maintenance. Resveratrol is known as a stack sirtuin activating compound.
Wait, how can a chemical produced by a plant trick human DNA into thinking it hasn't eaten?
It's an evolutionary concept called xenohormesis. The idea is that animals evolved to sense stress signaling molecules produced by the plants they eat. If a grapevine is stressed by drought or fungal infection, it produces resveratrol to protect itself.
Oh, I see.
When humans eat those stressed plants, our bodies sense the resveratrol, interpret it as a signal that the environment is becoming hostile and food might be scarce, and preemptively activate our own sirtuin survival pathways.
That is absolutely wild. We are eavesdropping on the chemical stress signals of plants to trigger our own survival genes. And what about terostilbin?
Terostilbin is a very closely related molecule, found primarily in blueberries. Dr. Kaufman favors it because, structurally, it has a couple of methoxy groups that make it highly lipophilic, meaning it dissolves in fat.
And why is that better?
Because of this, it crosses cell membranes much more efficiently than resveratrol, gets into the tissues faster, and stays in the bloodstream significantly longer. It flicks the same preservation switch in the instruction manual, but with better pharmacokinetics.
Okay, so resveratrol and terostilbin are calling down to the factory floor to initiate maintenance. But what about the power plant? We talked about the mitochondria leaking sparks and destroying their own DNA. How do we fix the mitochondrial mailroom?
That's where a molecule called NAD comes in. Nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, NAD. Dr. Kaufman actually personifies this molecule to help explain its incredibly complex vital role. She calls him Nick.
I love Nick. If we think of NAD as Nick, Dr. Kaufman asks us to picture him as a youthful, highly energetic kid who just got hired in the factory's mailroom, the mailroom being the mitochondria.
Right. Down the mitochondria, Nick's job is physical labor. He is literally carrying electrons and protons around the inner matrix. He shuttles the raw energetic currency down that bucket brigade, the electron transport chain, that allows ATP to be created.
Without Nick actively carrying those electrons, the power plant completely shuts down. He makes himself completely indispensable on the factory floor.
But Nick is ambitious. He's a hard worker, and his talents are needed elsewhere, so he gets a promotion. He gets called up to the head office. The nucleus.
And in the head office, Nick's new job is DNA repair. We talked about those sirtuins, and we talked about the repair crews fixing broken DNA strands, specifically a family of enzymes called PARPs.
Here is the crucial mechanism. Sirtuins and PARPs cannot function without NAD. They absolutely require it.
But here's where the metaphor needs to be extended, because Nick isn't just delivering a message in the head office, is he?
No, he is the consumable battery pack. When a PRP enzyme repairs a broken strand of DNA, it literally consumes a molecule of NAD to do it. It breaks Nick apart to use his chemical energy.
So as we age and we accumulate more and more DNA damage from radiation and toxins, these repair enzymes go into overdrive. They are frantically trying to fix the instruction manual. And in doing so, they are chewing through our supply of Nick.
Exactly. This is one of the foundational theories of mitochondrial aging. We are working Nick to death. The nuclear repair crews consume so much NAD that there isn't enough left down in the mitochondrial mailroom to efficiently run the power plant.
Energy drops, DNA repair stalls, and the system crashes.
So a massive part of Dr. Kaufman's toolkit involves precursors molecules like nicotinamide, NMN or NR, designed to give the body the raw materials to continuously manufacture more NICs to keep both systems running.
Okay, let's look at another tool for the power plant. And this one is fascinating because it is the ultimate Clark Kent of the toolkit. It's completely unglamorous. It's called metformin.
I love the metformin story. It's not extracted from ancient Indian roots or rare vines. It's a highly ubiquitous, heavily prescribed, decades-old pharmaceutical drug used by millions of people to manage type 2 diabetes.
But that mass ubiquity is exactly how its anti-aging superpowers were inadvertently discovered. Because millions of older folks all over the world were taking metformin strictly for blood sugar control, researchers eventually had a massive, multi-decade epidemiological data set to observe.
And what they noticed in the data was highly fortuitous and completely unexpected.
Right. They noticed that the diabetic patients taking metformin were, in many statistical cohorts, actively outliving non-diabetic patients who weren't taking it.
Which makes absolutely no biological sense at first glance, because diabetes is a disease that historically accelerates aging and cardiovascular decay.
So what was the drug actually doing to the factory?
Metformin acts as a mild, targeted metabolic stressor. It goes directly into the mitochondria and slightly mildly inhibits complex 1 of that electron transport chain we discussed.
It throws a tiny wrench into the bucket brigade.
Exactly. This slight inhibition causes a temporary drop in the efficiency of ATP production. This alters the ratio of cellular energy, specifically the AMP to ATP ratio. Mm-hmm. The cell possesses a master energy sensor called AMPK.
And what happens when AMPK detects this drop in energy?
It sounds the alarm. It thinks the body is starving.
It's another xenohermetic trick.
Yes. AMPK activation completely halts the cellular production of fats and cholesterols, increases insulin sensitivity to pull more glucose out of the blood, and initiates massive autophagy, forcing the cell to clean up its own garbage and recycle damaged proteins.
Metformin hides these profound systemic anti-aging mechanisms beneath the incredibly boring exterior of a standard generic diabetes medication.
The ultimate Clark Kent indeed.
Now we've talked about fixing the manual and fixing the power plant. What about the security guards? We know that rogue macrophages and senescent cells cause chronic systemic fires, that inflammaging process. What tool in Dr. Kaufman's box fights the fire?
For the security department, she brings out a molecule of a truly bizarre and surprising origin story, astaxanthin. She refers to this as the antidote to anger, and its primary source in nature is, well, the green muck you find floating in abandoned bird baths.
It sounds incredibly unappetizing, but the biology is beautiful. Astaxanthin is primarily produced by a tiny, highly resilient, single-celled green algae called Haematococcus pluvialis.
These algae live in small, temporary bodies of water all over the world. Ephemeral rain pools, dried-up fountains, shallow coastal rocks. Places where the environment can change drastically and become extremely hostile in a matter of hours. the water dries up, the salinity spikes, or the UV radiation from the sun gets lethally intense.
When this tiny algae is severely stressed by its environment, when it's angry, as Dr. Kaufman personifies it, it goes into extreme survival mode. It stops swimming, forms a hard cyst, and produces massive amounts of astaxanthin, turning itself from green to a deep blood red.
Astaxanthin is a carotenoid pigment. It is the exact molecule that makes salmon meat pink, because salmon eat the krill that eat the algae. For the algae, astaxanthin acts as an invincible chemical shield. It protects the algae's DNA and cellular machinery from UV destruction so it can lie dormant for years until the rain returns.
And when humans consume it?
Dr. Kaufman views it as a profound systemic soothing agent. Structurally, astaxanthin is unique. It has polar ends and a non-polar middle, allowing it to physically span the entire width of our cellular membranes.
And from that position, what does it do?
From this position, it acts as a highly potent antioxidant. It literally quells the fires of cellular stress, quenching singlet oxygen molecules and radically calming down the hyperactive inflammatory cytokines secreted by our rogue security guards.
It takes the desperate stress response of a tiny algae and uses it to cool down our entire factory. That is incredible. And joining astaxanthin in the anti-inflammatory toolkit is a molecule Dr. Kaufman calls the ancient traveler curcumin.
Curcumin's historical pedigree is staggering. Dr. Kaufman traces its use back over 5,000 years to Vedic India, where turmeric, the root that contains curcumin, was used medicinally as a culinary spice and heavily in religious ceremonies.
From there, it traveled to China around 700 AD, East Africa by 800 AD, and was highly praised by Avicenna, the legendary Persian physician, in the 11th century. It even has an illicit smuggling story. Marco Polo apparently smuggled it into Europe in 1280.
Dr. Kaufman points out an amazing linguistic fact. There are 53 different Sanskrit names for it. You don't get 53 different names in an ancient language unless you are doing some highly effective, deeply revered heavy lifting.
And in the human factory, its lifting is broad, systemic, and multi-pathway. While some tools, like metformin, are highly specific to one enzyme like AMPK, curcumin is a pleiotropic agent. It targets broad systemic maintenance.
Specifically, it is a master inhibitor of NFKB, which is a protein complex that controls the transcription of DNA related to cytokine production and cell survival.
So it basically goes up to the head office and shreds the memos that tell the security guards to cause inflammation. It walks the factory floor, sweeping up the oxidative rust, while actively telling the immune system to stand down and relax.
Exactly. Broad maintenance is vital. But sometimes, as the factory degrades, you need something that feels a bit more like a direct, highly visible intervention. Which brings us to the waste management department and a molecule called carnosine. Dr. Kaufman literally uses the word magic to describe this one.
The data she references regarding carnosine is definitely dramatic. She notes that in control laboratory settings, if you take senescent, old, grumpy human cells that are nearing the end of their replicative lifespan and you bathe them in carnosine, they actively exhibit youthful characteristics again.
She points to studies on rodents where chronologically old mice given carnosine maintain shiny, thick fur coats, remain physically active in their cages, and live significantly longer than the control groups.
It improves wound healing, reduces the rate of telomere shortening, and she even notes that when applied topically in eye drops, it can dissolve the protein aggregates that cause cataracts, literally restoring vision.
It sounds like the fountain of youth, but what is the actual mechanism? How does it perform this magic?
It goes directly back to the waste management problem we discussed. Glycation. The caramelization of our tissues by stray sugar molecules. Carnosine acts as a sacrificial lamb.
Sacrificial lamb. Explain that.
Carnosine is a dipeptide composed of two amino acids. It is highly reactive with sugars. So when those chaotic, sticky glucose molecules are floating around looking for a collagen protein to crash into and ruin, the carnosine jumps in the way.
So it takes a bullet.
Exactly. The sugar glycates the carnosine instead of your vital structural proteins. The body then flushes the ruined carnosine out, leaving your factory machinery perfectly intact. It also acts as a heavy metal chelator, binding to toxic copper and zinc and sweeping them out of the brain. It is the ultimate janitorial sweep.
And working right alongside carnosine in the waste department is a highly focused specialist called Pyrdoc Salmon.
Yes. If carnosine is the broad janitor, Pyrdoc Salmon is the highly paid consultant brought in for one specific job. Pyrdoc Salmon is a form of vitamin B6. Its sole major function in Dr. Kaufman's framework is to prevent the formation of those AGs, advanced glycation end products.
It inhibits the cascade of chemical reactions that turn a simple sugar attachment into a permanent cross-linked stiffened protein.
So between carnosine sacrificing itself and pyridoxamine stopping the chemical cascade, you are mounting a massive defense against the caramelization of the factory.
Precisely. Let's briefly hit a few other fascinating diverse tools she includes, starting with alpha-lipoic acid. Dr. Kaufman calls this one the stealthy secret agent.
It really is stealthy. As she jokingly points out, lipo sounds like fat and acid sounds painful. Its chemical name is 1-methyl-2-diethylene-3-pentanoic acid. It has zero marketing pizzazz. It has never made the front page of a health magazine.
But biochemically, it quietly gets massive amounts of work done under the radar. It is a potent thiol antioxidant, but its superpower is its solubility. Most antioxidants are either water-soluble, like vitamin C, meaning they only work in the watery cytoplasm of the cell, or they are fat-soluble, like vitamin E, meaning they only work inside the lipid cell membranes.
And alpha-lipoic acid?
It is both. It operates seamlessly in both water and fat environments, making it incredibly versatile at neutralizing free radicals anywhere in the factory. It can even cross the blood-brain barrier.
Then we have apigenin, which brings us all the way back to ancient history. It's a flavonoid found in many herbs, parsley, celery, oregano, but its most famous and abundant source is chamomile tea.
Which the ancient Egyptians were absolutely obsessed with. They revered the chamomile flower, dedicating it to their supreme sun god, Ra.
Dr. Kaufman notes that hieroglyphic records show Egyptian noble women used crushed chamomile petals directly on their skin for its anti-aging properties, and chamomile oil was a key ingredient in the preservation and mummification process.
They knew it preserved tissue long before they knew what a flavonoid was. In modern cellular biology, apigenin does something incredible for our mailroom worker, Nick. It is a potent inhibitor of an enzyme called CD38.
This is a crucial connection. CD38 is an enzyme that naturally increases as we age, and its primary job is to aggressively destroy NAD. It literally chews up our supply of NIC.
By taking apigenin, you inhibit the CD38, effectively protecting your NAD pool and allowing the mitochondria and the DNA repair crews to keep functioning.
That's like hiring a bodyguard for NIC. I love how these pathways interconnect. From ancient Egypt, we fast forward to 1992, to a compound that actually did make the front page of the New York Times, sulforaphane.
Ah, the famous broccoli compound. Dr. Paul Talalay at the Johns Hopkins Laboratory for Molecular Pharmacology isolated this compound and discovered its profound health-promoting properties. Popular Mechanics even listed his isolation of sulforaphane as one of the top 100 scientific discoveries of the 20th century.
And how does broccoli fix the factory?
It operates on a pathway called KEAP1-NRF2. Under normal conditions, a protein called KEAP1 holds onto a transcription factor called NRF2, keeping it inactive. But when sulforaphane enters the cell, it chemically modifies KEAP1. KEAP1 lets go of NRF2.
And NRF2 goes to the nucleus.
Yes. NRF2 then floods into the nucleus, binds to the DNA, and activates a massive suite of over 200 antioxidant and detoxification genes. It is arguably the most potent, naturally occurring inducer of our body's own internal defense mechanisms. It doesn't just act as an antioxidant, it commands the factory to build millions of its own antioxidants.
Finally, we round out the high points of her toolkit with melatonin, which I think will confuse some people because melatonin is sold in every grocery store as a mild sleep aid for jet lag.
It is widely known as a sleep hormone, produced by the pineal gland to regulate circadian rhythms. But Dr. Kaufman highlights its far older true evolutionary identity as an ancient indolamine molecule. Long before eyes or brains evolved to sense light and sleep, melatonin evolved in primitive bacteria billions of years ago.
Why did bacteria need a sleep hormone?
They didn't. They needed a protector. Melatonin evolved as a deeply powerful, highly targeted antioxidant. And because mitochondria evolved from those primitive bacteria, melatonin retains a special affinity for mitochondria today.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
It is one of the very few antioxidants that can penetrate deep into the mitochondrial matrix and actively scavenge the toxic free radicals being thrown off by the electron transport chain right at the source, where other antioxidants simply cannot reach.
Okay, so if we look at this toolkit as a whole, we aren't just looking at a random list of vitamins. Dr. Kaufman has assembled a highly diverse, targeted array of molecular agents based on their specific mechanisms of action.
Some trigger genetic sirtuin regulators, some apt to sacrificial lambs to clear out cellular garbage, some boost mitochondrial efficiency via AMPK, some act as bodyguards for NAD, and some soothe systemic immune inflammation.
It is an incredibly comprehensive, biologically elegant defensive strategy.
But this raises the ultimate practical question. What does this all mean for the listener? We have this massive, complex factory, and we have this incredible, historically rich, chemically complex toolkit of molecules. How does Dr. Kaufman suggest someone actually uses this information? How do you turn this dense cellular science into a daily, highly personalized strategy?
This is where we move into part three of our deep dive, the Kaufman approach. She doesn't just dump the science and walk away. She provides a framework for implementation. And her very first step is absolutely critical, yet it is the step almost everyone skips. Before you formulate a plan, before you buy a single supplement, you have to establish a rigorous personal baseline.
She insists that you take a detailed, almost tedious aging questionnaire. You have to sit down and honestly document exactly how you feel right now in this current stage of decay. You have to rate your energy levels at 2 p.m., the specific aches and pains in your joints when you wake up, the quality of your sleep, the elasticity of your skin, your memory recall.
And the reason she insists on this intense documentation is due to a fascinating, deeply ingrained psychological quirk of human biology. She's found in her observation that once people start a targeted protocol and begin to feel better, they almost immediately forget their original baseline of suffering.
It is entirely true. Our brains are wired to normalize our current state. When you feel good, you assume you've always felt good. You completely forget the random stabbing knee pain until then when it comes back.
If you don't write down in ink that your baseline energy on a Tuesday afternoon was a miserable 4 out of 10, when you finally hit a sustained 8 out of 10, you won't appreciate the biological victory you've achieved. You'll just think, well, I'm sleeping better.
You lose the data. Once the written baseline is firmly established, the goal is to formulate a plan that comprehensively covers all the different categories of aging we discussed. Because the factory is a system, you can't just fix one department.
If you optimize the mitochondria to produce massive energy, but you ignore the DNA repair crews, you are just accelerating the accumulation of mutated cells. You need broad coverage. To help with this, Dr. Kaufman developed a proprietary rating system for her agents, and she offers a highly recommended starting point that she calls the top five.
And according to her specific framework and mathematical rating, those foundational top five agents are tirasilbin, or resveratrol, astaxanthin, nicotinamide, curcumin, and carnosine.
If you analyze that specific combination, you see the elegance of the system. By taking those five, her framework suggests that you are simultaneously providing targeted support to the epigenetic DNA regulators, the mitochondrial power plants, the inflammatory security guards, and the cellular quality control and waste mechanisms all at once. It is a broad spectrum shield.
But, and this is a massive flashing neon but, she surrounds this protocol with some incredibly crucial caveats that require a major psychological shift. She is very firm in setting expectations for anyone who attempts this. First and foremost, she reiterates forcefully that this is not a diet.
Right. It is completely divorced from diet culture. It's not a 30-day lose weight fast program. It's not a juice cleanse or a summer shred. While you might feel an increase in metabolic energy and maybe even inadvertently lose some visceral fat over time, that is a secondary, highly downstream side effect. It is not the primary biological goal.
Secondly, this is not a short-term fad you do for a month and then quit. This is a lifelong, permanent strategy. The factory is going to be under relentless assault from oxygen, glucose, radiation, and time every single day for the rest of your life. You cannot fight a permanent enemy with a temporary weapon.
Which leads directly to her third and perhaps most profoundly difficult caveat to accept, the plateau effect. This requires breaking down how we are psychologically conditioned.
Yes, let's really dive into this because I think this is where most people fail when trying to improve their longevity. When someone initiates a protocol like this, when they suddenly provide their starving factory with all these missing tools, NAD precursors, and sirtuin activators, they often experience a highly noticeable, almost euphoric burst of energy and clarity within the first 10 to 14 days. The machinery suddenly spins up to optimal efficiency.
You feel amazing, your knee stops hurting, you don't need a nap at 3 p.m., your brain fog clears. You think, this is it, I'm literally aging backwards. Next week I'll feel like I'm 18 again.
Exactly. We are conditioned by diet and fitness culture to expect linear, infinite, visible improvements. If I lift weights every week, my bicep gets visibly bigger every week. But cellular anti-aging does not work like that. Eventually, and usually quite soon, that new, optimized level of cellular efficiency just becomes your new normal. You hit a ceiling, you plateau.
And when people hit that plateau, when the euphoric upward swing stops, they almost always lose faith. They think, well, I feel the same today as I did last month. The supplements must have stopped working. My body got used to them. Time to quit and find the next fad.
But Dr. Kaufman emphasizes a profound, counterintuitive shift in perspective here. In the relentless, progressive, biologically inevitable battle against aging, stagnation is actually a massive, absolute victory.
I really want the listener to let that sink in. Stagnation is the goal. If you are 45 years old and you feel the exact same physical capabilities, the same energy, the same joint mobility at 50 that you did at 45, you are winning the war.
You have halted the decline. Decelerating the rate of biological deterioration is the entire point of the protocol. It is an invisible victory, which makes it psychologically difficult to maintain, but biologically it is a triumph over entropy.
Finally, we have to reiterate her closing rules and our disclaimers. We cannot predict the future. This protocol and these molecules do not come with an ironclad guarantee that you won't get a disease. Biology is messy and chaotic. It absolutely does not guarantee a miraculously longer chronological life. We simply don't have rigorous, randomized, placebo-controlled human trials standing 100 years yet. We have rodent data, cell culture data, and epidemiological clues.
Her entire framework is built on the scientific concept of actively, intelligently decreasing your relative risk based on the cellular mechanisms we currently imperfectly understand. It is a highly educated, theoretically sound hedge against biological decay. And of course, anyone looking to explore these potent agents must do so cautiously, slowly, and in direct consultation with their personal physician to monitor for interactions and specific metabolic reactions.
Exactly. Safety, patients, and personal medical context are paramount. You don't overhaul a factory without consulting the lead engineer.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Which brings us to the end of our deep dive today. Let's synthesize the ultimate take-home message here. Aging isn't just some vague, mystical fading of the light. It isn't a curse from the gods, and it isn't just bad luck. According to Dr. Kaufman's exhaustive, deeply researched synthesis, aging is a series of very specific, highly addressable mechanical failures within the incredible interconnected factory of the human body. By deeply understanding exactly how our epigenetic manual gets misread, how our mitochondria leak destructive sparks, how our maintenance systems get overwhelmed, and how our tissues caramelize, we can theoretically use nature's ancient, highly evolved molecular toolkit to step in and perform targeted maintenance, significantly decreasing our risks of catastrophic cellular decay.
It fundamentally transforms the entire human concept of aging. It moves it from a space of passive, depressing inevitability into a space of active, strategic, and highly empowered biological engagement.
But it leaves us with one final, deeply provocative philosophical thought to ponder. If science continues on this exact trajectory, if we eventually prove, definitively and clinically, that we can use these tools to pause our biological clocks, if you can remain functionally, vibrantly, energetically in your 30s or 40s for 3, 4, or 5 decades longer, how would that drastically change the way you plan the next 50 years of your life? If the rapid deterioration of time is no longer the ultimate terrifying enemy dictating your choices, what actually becomes your ultimate priority?
It's a huge question to think about.
This episode is based on the book Why We Age and How to Stop It, The Kaufman Protocol by Dr. Sandra Kaufman, featured with the author's kind permission. You'll find more about Dr. Kaufman and her work in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the book you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
The mirror keeps a ledger of the years I've spent. Soft folds and silver markings, every small lament. But underneath the surface, in the engine of the cell, a quiet fire is fading where the young years used to dwell. I won't surrender gently, I won't just let it slide. There's a science in the silence, and I've got it on my side. So I'll fight with grace, I'll fight with reason in my hands. No fountain and no fairy tale. mitochondria flicker, the energy runs thin. Resveratrol and curcumin, the data written in. It's not a 30-day illusion, not a potion you can buy. Just an honest, careful reckoning with how we live and die. The body's like a factory, the workers grow so tired. But knowledge is the kindling, and the choice can light the fire. Walk it slowly, talk it over, with a healer by your side. Not to cheat the clock forever, just to take the years in stride. So I'll fight with grace, I'll fight with a reason in mind.